And the word perfect means brought to completion, fully accomplished, or fully developed. So God is saying that He will have a mature, complete, finished product. It has the idea of a right relationship to God, expressed in undivided obedience and unblemished life. It's used in Matthew 5 and verse 48, translated perfect. It tells us that we are to be perfect even as our Heavenly Father is perfect. Also in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 14, and there it's translated full age, which gives a pretty good idea of what's really involved. We're to come to full age, full development. And then he says that ye may be not only perfect, but entire. The word entire means wholeness or soundness, completeness. It's speaking about that which is undamaged, intact, and blameless. So he's trying to produce something that is whole, it's sound, it's complete, it's undamaged, intact, and without blame. Or you could say without any sort of fault. He wants us to be complete in all parts of spiritual life. That is, whole in every part. He's calling us to press on to a complete and fully balanced life of holiness. That's what the call of God is. Fully balanced. Everything in its proper place, spiritually speaking. Then he says, wanting nothing. Literally, in nothing coming short. Or in nothing falling behind. The idea is that he does not want us to be inferior or deficient. So these tests, which are producing patience, are to really accomplish something. And they're to bring us to full age, to full development, so that in nothing we would come up short. And when you consider that we're to grow to the fullness of the stature of Christ, in a sense he's saying, I don't want you to be one inch shorter than what you should be. I want you to grow up completely. Full development in every area of life. Verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Now, he's dealing with wisdom here, because we're going to have to see this as God sees it, or else it will swamp us. There are just so many things in life that if we don't see them like God views them, and as God is working in them, they'll swamp us. They'll overcome us. We need wisdom. Wisdom is the real ability to understand and to see what's really going on. It's not just data, but it's understanding how to implement the data. It's not just knowledge, but it's knowing how to use the knowledge. You can have a lot of data, and that doesn't mean you have any wisdom whatsoever. There's a lot of people with knowledge, and it's very obvious by the way they're living life and by the things they do and don't do, they don't have wisdom. They're not wise people. You can give information to some people and they'll botch it up completely. You give information to other people and they know exactly what to do with it because they have wisdom. Now, we all have to admit that we lack wisdom. Now, he writes this in such a way that we have to admit it. If any man lack wisdom. He should just say, you all lack wisdom, pray for it. You better pray for wisdom. But he doesn't put it in that kind of a vein. He puts it in a vein where we have to admit, yes, Lord, I lack wisdom. I'm one of those men that lacks wisdom. I'm one of those women that lacks wisdom. Well, everybody should say that. We all lack wisdom. Now, wisdom is the correct use and application of knowledge. Now, he's giving us some knowledge here about trials. And he's telling us what trials will do for us. But if we do not really understand how to apply this knowledge, then these trials will not work for us. So we need wisdom. We need God's wisdom. See, it's God's wisdom that has set this up. He's doing it all in His wisdom. So if we don't have His wisdom, we won't understand what He's doing. This is an all-wise God who set it up this way. Life is very strange. Life is a very peculiar thing. And you look at it sometimes, can't make heads nor tails out of it. You can't figure out whether you're going up or going down. You're not sure if you're in the middle of the road or in a ditch. It's hard to tell sometimes what's going on. But God set it up. And God knows what life can produce if man will yield to Him. So it's all been set up in His wisdom. But if we're not tied to that wisdom, then we're just always going to be going through a fog. And God doesn't want us to always be going through a fog. It's hard enough to go through a fog just periodically, let alone every day of every week of every month and so on. That gets tired real fast. It's a tiresome way to live life. Wisdom is also spiritual insight to save us from the follies of the flesh. We need some spiritual insight to save us from the follies of the flesh, to save us from carnal reasonings. In the midst of a trial, the carnal mind is working a million miles an hour. It's trying to figure out the quickest way out of this. It's not thinking about how this is going to mature the soul and bring us closer to God in the Spirit. It's like, get me out of this. I don't like this. This is uncomfortable. This is too much pain. The body's screaming. The carnal mind is screaming. And God is saying, just be still. Calm down. Look to me. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. Those lions aren't going to bite. The fire's not going to burn you up. But you're just going to have to go through this. So we need spiritual insight. Wisdom is the ability to view the course of life from God's perspective. To be able to view it from the way God sees it. We need this ability to view the course of life from God's perspective. We need God to lift us above life so that we can really see life. We're right down in the middle of the forest. We can't see the forest for the trees. And that's the way it is oftentimes in our Christian lives. We do not really see what's going on. We're just facing these big trees, these problems. We don't see how it all fits together. We're in a maze. Here we are in this maze, and all we see are these walls. Everywhere we look are walls, but there's a way out of it. And God knows how to get us out of it, but He's got to be able to lift us up so we can see it from His vantage point. God has a real good vantage point on life. Man doesn't have a good vantage point. As long as we're just plugging along, using our own minds, somehow trying to get from here to glory, we're not going to get there. And if we do, it's only going to be by the skin of our teeth, by the grace of God, and we're not going to find too many treasures laid up over on the other side either. Wisdom is forming and living the correct plan to gain the desired results. Forming and living the correct plan. Every year, January 1st, there are 5 billion New Year's resolutions, new plans. Those plans, they don't accomplish a thing. But the only thing they accomplish is more frustration. So they do for the average person. But we need to have the correct plan established by God in our minds, in our hearts, so that we really understand what life is about and where we're going. That's wisdom. We need wisdom. We have not established too many plans that we would give us an A+ for. The grading on some of the plans that we've come up with, we might get a few C-. Most of them are more in the D and F category. So then he says, if you lack wisdom, then let him ask of God. And the Greek is present tense, imperative mood, which means that it's a command that's in continuous action. So let him keep on asking. And it's a command. And really we could discard the word let, and it would be more just keep on asking. You recognize you need wisdom? Keep asking for it. God's commanding us to do something. God has told us all sorts of things that we should pray, but you know, we're real slow to pray a lot of these things. It's really amazing. There's all sorts of things that we should be praying that we really don't even pray. We need to ask God for wisdom. We need to say, Lord, give me wisdom. Let me see what's going on in life. Let me see where I'm going. Help me to see. Show me what's going on from your perspective. Let me get the right data and then show me what to do with the data. Just to collect the information is not enough. We've got to know what to do with it. Solomon understood that when he was made king, he couldn't be king. He knew he couldn't be king. And God said, now what will you ask of me? Solomon said, give me wisdom. I don't know how to go in. I don't know how to come out. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to be a king. These people are looking to me. I don't have the slightest idea how to be king. I need wisdom. And God gave him wisdom so that he had more wisdom than any other man on the face of the earth. And you can see that in the Proverbs and in the other writings that came from Solomon's pen. And things said about him and how he's able to build up his kingdom and how he was able to exercise for a time proper judgment. And God gave him wisdom. This is in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 5 to 12. He didn't ask for wealth. He didn't ask for power. He didn't ask for prominence. He didn't ask for prosperity. He asked for wisdom. That's exactly what we need. We don't need more money. We don't really need a better job. We don't need a better girlfriend, better wife. I mean, that is not, you know, man looks at all the wrong things. He really does. And Christians do the same thing in all sorts of different situations of life. We need God's wisdom. We need to see life as God sees it and understand really what God is trying to accomplish. And there's all sorts of situations just in life itself where you can understand that here's the boss, here's the supervisor, here's the foreman. They have wisdom. They know how to do these things. And then you see the laborers. They don't know what to do. But generally, these people are always second-guessing their boss. They're always giving their opinion. They don't know anything about what's going on and what's being built, but they've got an opinion. Well, that sounds pretty familiar. We've got an opinion. Lord, let us tell you what's going on. We'll be glad to tell you what we think we need. We're sure we need this. This is the way it should be. And I say, please, trust me. I know what'll make your lives happy. I know what'll satisfy. But man ends up looking at all the wrong things, at least quite a few times along the pathway of life. Now, God says that he will give this wisdom liberally. Now, the Greek doesn't mean liberally. It just means simply. He will give it simply. It also carries the idea of answering to the need without a second thought. Now, it does carry the idea of giving in abundance. But that isn't really the main point. The main point is that God will just give. You ask God for wisdom, and he says, well, sure. Sure, why not? It's what I want to do. He just gives it simply. It isn't that we really have to twist his arm, beg him. But if we really ask in faith, and we really know we need wisdom, and he knows that we know, and we're showing our dependence, he says, sure, I'll show you. Here, this is what you need to do. This is the way to live. He just wants to give it simply. Sure, I'll be glad to give my wisdom. That's what I'm here for. I want you to trust me. I want to be able to show you the way. A parent and a child. Here's the child trying to do something. And this happened in my family numerous times. My son is trying to do something. I said, now all you have to do is give it to me. I'll be glad to do it. It's just a real simple thing. But the parent really can't do it until the child wants the parent to, until the child acknowledges that he has a need. And then the parent just does it. It's just a simple thing. It's not some big thing where my son has to bribe me or my daughter has to bake me 4 cakes or anything like that. It's just a real simple thing. And that's the way it is in our relationship with God. It really is. The devil has really blocked us so that God is so far off, and we've got to pray, we've got to do these things, and then finally we might hear from God. The devil has really made our relationship with God at various times in various areas just like it's impossible. But those are lies of the devil. Kenneth Weiss says that God gives with simplicity and without reserve. So both ideas are there, but the main idea is just the simplicity. Just simply. Just gives it. Just shows the manner in which he gives. He wants to. He delights to. And he further shows that by saying that he upbraideth not. That is, he reproaches not. God will not rebuke, blame, discredit, disgrace, scorn, or censure the person. You won't say, "Oh, you dummy. I'm not going to give you wisdom. You should have it yourself." He doesn't rebuke the person. He doesn't belittle the person. He said, "Boy, you're stupid." God never does that. That's demonic spirits. Demonic spirits make us feel stupid, like we have failed and all these other things. See, God is not reluctant to give. He delights to provide limitless wisdom. He wants you to make it through life. And you know what? He wants you to make it through life the right way. I don't think we have to go down all these wrong pathways and find out that the right pathway is over here because we went down these 15 wrong ones. I don't think that's the will of God. I think that just shows that we're still carnal. I think that shows that we are still heavily impacted by demons. I think that shows that we're not as sensitive nor as dependent upon God as we need to be. But Jesus didn't go down all sorts of wrong pathways. And you know the devil was after him, and there was all sorts of pressure on him. He didn't go down any wrong pathways. God's will is that now go down these 10 wrong ones, and then you'll know that these were wrong, and then finally I can get through to you. That's not the way God wants it. He wants us to be able to stand there with the roads going 25 different directions and say, "Lord, I don't have the slightest idea where to go. Show me. Show me through your word. Show me through counsel. Show me by your spirit. Give me angelic help, but Lord, I'm not going to move until I know." If people would pray more that way about decisions in their life, they'd get a lot more answers right from God. But most people are too hasty, called impatience. And instead of being still and just waiting for the salvation of God, just waiting for God to lead, they're going to run off and say, "Well, this is probably the right way. You know, back me up in this, okay?" That's not the way to do it. It's not the way to live life. We need to be slower and be more careful and waiting much more upon God. We need to cultivate a life of waiting upon God. Now he tells the person, he says in verse 6, "But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed." Now the whole condition for receiving is faith. Ask in faith. Faith is immovable confidence, unswerving conviction, which circumstances cannot alter. Immovable confidence, unswerving conviction. That's how we're to ask. I need wisdom. He's the source of wisdom. He wants to give wisdom. I'm asking for it. I'm accepting it. And I'm not going to be shaken from that. And I'm going to believe that God is now imparting to me wisdom. And this is not some sort of a game, mind over matter, kind of pretensies. And now I'm going to pretend whatever's in my mind is God. But I'm really believing God to feed my mind. And if it's a real serious type decision, I'm going to check it out. I'm going to get some counsel from others. I'm going to have other people pray with me. I'm not going to make any hasty decision. I'm not going to assume that just because pop into my mind comes this piece of information that is God, I'm going to test the spirits. And God says, "Fine." God says, "Go ahead and put me to the test. I don't mind that at all. You need confirmation, I'll give you confirmation. Whatever you need to make that step, I'll give it to you, as long as you just keep looking to me." And God delights to do that. Some people think, well, if I pray and something comes to my mind, if I don't follow through on that right now, lack of faith, I'm somehow turning against God, I've got to just do it. That's not what Gideon did. That's not what other men of God have done. They checked things out carefully. Things were too serious. You can't just get a piece of information and run with it necessarily. You know, in that case, we're not in a place where we can be so certain that what's in our mind is really God. We've already found out many, many times that what's in our mind is not God. We found it out the hard way. So there's nothing now going to say, well, all things have changed. Now whenever I pray, immediately God speaks right to my mind. I know God's voice. I'm never going to be fooled again. Hardy har har. We're still going to be fooled if we're not careful. And that's why we need to keep submitted and humble before one another and testing the spirits, having people pray with us, whatever else we need. And then as we take the step, then take it and put full confidence in God. It says, nothing wavering. Rotherham translates it, nothing doubting. Now this word expresses the hesitation which vacillates between faith and unbelief. And whenever there's this type of vacillation, it will always incline toward the unbelief. Whenever doubt starts to come in and there's this wavering, kind of like this reed being blown in the wind, back and forth. Which side is it going to fall down on? Unbelief. It will. It just does. The person has opened up doors to the wrong kind of spirits, and those spirits will end up taking advantage. It pictures a mind so filled with uncertainty and indecision that a proper choice can't be made. When your mind is swamped with uncertainty and indecision, it's not possible to make a right decision. The Kingdom Interlinear translates it, nothing judging for self dividedly. It's talking about a divided man. He's divided in his mind. And that man is not going to receive from God. He says he wavereth like the wave of the sea. The man divided is like the unresting waves of the ocean. The sea here is used as a symbol of unrest. It's that which is unstable. It shows man living outside of God's stable provisions. Those stable provisions are only found as we really put faith in God. Okay, I'm going to trust you, Lord. Your word says it. Your ministers say it. Your counselors say it. It bears witness with my spirit. But I hear this other voice. It's trying to badger me. It's trying to get me to doubt and to fear. But I'm going to fight those doubts. I'm going to fight those fears. I've done everything to check this out. This is you. This is not you. I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to set sail down this pathway, period. That's what I'm going to do. But a person must be adamant. When you know that you've got this decision and this is what you've got to do it, trusting God for His power and strength and anointing to do it. He says, for let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. Don't imagine, expect, or suppose that this one will receive anything from God. The man whose mind is divided is not properly persuaded of God's sufficiency, and therefore he receives nothing. See, this man is not truly looking to God, is what the whole point is. And it really is. Either we're trusting God or we're not. It really is. 75% trusting God, 25% doubting God is not faith in God. It's either you're going to trust God or you're not. That's what his point is here. Now, I don't think that God waits for us to have 100% faith before he moves in our behalf. Now, ideally, that's what he wants. But realistically, he might be moved by 51% faith sometimes. I mean, I don't really know. I don't know exactly what is happening as we're looking to God and he finally moves. I don't know really how much faith we actually have if you were looking at it on a 100% scale. But I don't think that we have too many times thus far had 100% total, absolute faith, therefore God moved. I think there have definitely been times But I think there have been some doubts, and there's been some fears, and God moved anyway. That's called grace and mercy. So this is a little bit oversimplified, and don't let it become totally that way in your mind. Because see, then the devil has a real advantage. All you can do at this point in time is believe God the best that you can. And at the same time, you're saying, Lord, help me with my unbelief. Help me with my fears. Help me with my doubts. Deliver me of those things. But Lord, right now I'm believing you as best as I can, and I'm trusting that you will move. Even though I still have these weaknesses, even though I still have these fears, even though I haven't been delivered of these demonic spirits, Lord, move in my behalf. Do you think he moves? He's moving today. He moved yesterday. We don't have perfect faith, and he's still moving. See, we don't have perfect understanding, and he's still moving. Now, I don't know where the lines are, and I don't know how God evaluates each person and how much he's demanding of each person, but that's between God and that individual. And all you can do is trust God the best that you know how. And then at the same time, ask God to help you have more faith, more confidence. And you say, Lord, I'm sorry I don't have more faith. Really, based on what we read in this book and what we've read God do through other ministries, what we've seen God do in our own lives, we should have faith that really would be moving mountains. And at times we find we don't even have faith that would move a little molehill. And Lord, we're sorry. Lord, we repent. We're sorry we're so gullible to accept the lies of the devil. But yet God is still moving in our behalf. God is really an amazingly good God. It's just a really incredible thing. So he's making a point to get something across. He's trying to show us how vital faith is. But he's not saying now only perfect faith moves God's hand. We've had quite a bit of imperfect faith, and it still moved the hand of God. You know, there's times that we felt like we had perfect faith. God didn't move. And there's times we thought that we did, God moved, but maybe if he showed us how much faith we really had, maybe we'd be surprised. Maybe we didn't have quite as much faith as we thought. I don't really know. There's a lot of things that go on sight unseen. We don't really know. We don't perceive everything that's happening in life. And I just mention this to get you to think, to realize that there's this commodity called faith, and so to speak, it's supposed to be up to the 100 mark, but maybe it's only up to about the 75 mark and God will move, depending on what our maturity is or lack of maturity. God knows exactly when to move in our behalf, but he is asking for faith. But whether or not we're able to give him perfect faith and then he moves, that just doesn't seem to be the case to my mind at this point. Now, I think he's trying to move us more toward that. And I don't really know for certain what God requires in each and every situation. And neither do you. But the best thing that we can do is just say, Lord, I'm trusting you as fully as I know how, and I'm going to keep looking to you. I'm going to get counsel. I'm going to get prayer. I'm going to be in your word. I'm going to make the decisions. Oh, and I hope, Lord, that this will be enough so you'll keep moving in my life. I need you to move in my life. Now, if somebody has that attitude, that mentality, you know God's going to move in their behalf. Even if they still have certain problems with the flesh and problems with demons and other things, you know God's going to be moving in their behalf. You just know he will. Verse 8, he says, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Literally, two-souled. A two-souled man. It shows a man of two minds, or as is described here, as though he had two souls, as though he was two different people, halting between two opinions. 1 Kings 18:21. How long will you halt between two opinions? They didn't keep doing that too much longer. They've been doing it for an awful long time leading up to this encounter there between the prophets of Baal and the prophet of God, Elijah. And it's trying to serve God and mammon at the same time. God and the world. It just doesn't work. We've tried it. in various ways. It hasn't worked. It hasn't satisfied. It hasn't brought rewards and rejoicing and peace and rest to our souls. It's brought just a back and forth, a frustration, a despair, anxiety. Whenever you're going back and forth, okay, now this is what I'm going to do. And you're just about ready to do it, and then another thought comes, I'll do this. Okay, I'll do it. Then another, and now you're back over here. And now you're back. You get worn out real fast. Well, that's what the devil tries to do in our lives. Make us a tennis ball. Back and forth over the net we go. Boy, that tennis ball, that must be really battered and bruised. If a tennis ball had a personality, after a tennis match, it would feel so unwanted, so rejected. He didn't want me. He didn't want me. Then they finally threw me off the court and they brought new tennis balls in. I mean, so rejected. Well, that's what happens in our lives. Back and forth, back and forth. No real direction. That's what the devil is trying to do. That's what he's trying to accomplish. That's why we have to sell out to God. That's why God is saying, now get serious. Really get serious about this life. You say you love me, you say you'll serve me, you're reading my word, now do it. I mean, God sometimes speaks rather forcibly. He says, either on my side or on his side, one or the other. But stop sitting on the fence. Pretty uncomfortable. A lot of people are sitting on the fence. And they're just kind of tottering and, well, they kind of lean this way, and then they lean the other, and then they're back, and then back and forth. There's no peace in life like that. He says, purify your hearts, ye double-minded. That's in chapter 4 and verse 8. Same Greek. Purify your hearts, ye double-souled. He says this man is unstable. Literally, he's not standing down. The point is, he has nothing to stand on. His whole foundation is unsteady, unreliable. There's nothing firm. That's the way his life is. His instability impacts his entire life. All his ways are affected. And really and truly, this is the most miserable man on planet Earth. There's only one way to have joy and peace. Full surrender to God. There's no other way. It won't work any other way. And he says in verse 9, let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted. Now, the brother of low degree, this speaks of one of a humble station in life. Means he doesn't have money. He doesn't have a lot of material possessions. And he's not going to be moving up the corporate ladder and one day be the president of Boeing. He's down there as a janitor. He's down there just a common laborer, and that's probably what he's going to be his whole life as far as just in the workaday world. And he's not going to move from the neighborhood he's in to a wealthier neighborhood and then another wealthier one. He's just not. And there are a lot of people, they have a humble station in life. They just do. And that's more or less their lot, and they're going to just stay there. But this man accepts it with a humble spirit. And he is not seized by demons of materialism. And he's not listening to false doctrines regarding Christian prosperity and blessing packs, making God some sort of Wall Street tycoon that if you invest with him, your stock will continue to increase steadily, and before too long, you'll drive Lincolns and live in mansions. He has no ears to hear such lies, such false doctrine, which it is. They're lies, and it's false doctrine. It's not according to biblical truths. God talks about prosperity, but not like these preachers, unfortunately, are preaching it. See, and as this man accepts where he is in life, it doesn't faze him. Because he keeps his eyes upon Jesus. He's not keeping his eyes on the Joneses. He doesn't care what the Joneses are doing. He doesn't care that they've added on their house. He doesn't care that they've painted their house. He doesn't care they bought new furniture. He doesn't care that they've re-landscaped their yard. He doesn't care they bought a new car. Could care less. He has his eyes on eternal glory. Now, this is exactly how we have to live this life. And some people would have a lot more peace in their lives at present if they could really get this in their hearts and realize that we're not in some sort of competition to show who's spiritual by who has the most material blessing. That does not show who's spiritual at all, necessarily. Look at the Rockefellers. They'd be the most spiritual people on planet Earth. And they're headed for the lake of fire. And the Kennedys and all the others. And there are some wealthy people, wealthy beyond anything we could comprehend. I mean, they got billions. They got money until you can't even count it all. They need 14 computers just to keep track of their money. And that's just about it. That's really no exaggeration. And they don't have any spirituality. They don't have their names written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So here's the brother of low degree. But he's accepted by God. And he loves God. And God loves him. He's happy in life. And he'll just keep going on in life, aspiring to heavenly riches. And if he's able to live in a better house, fine. If not, no big deal. Doesn't matter to him. If he's able to drive a better car, fine. He knows God will meet his needs. If he needs a better car in order to carry out his ministry, God will give him that. God will make a way. If he has to work and do other things to make it possible with God's hand upon him, that's what he'll do. But he's not going to be snared with the desire for temporal earthly riches. Having a $50 bill in his wallet rather than two fives doesn't matter to him. He doesn't care. He's not trying to impress anybody with having pictures of presidents on green paper. Doesn't matter to him. It's what it is. And it's not worth the numbers on the paper anyway. You know, I mean, it's just all a facade. He's in a monopoly game where everybody's bankrupt. And he's the only one that recognizes it, so he doesn't care about that. And you only take out of this life what you brought into this life. You didn't bring anything in. It's not going to take anything out. So it's showing a man who's not bothered by his station in life. It doesn't bother him he's poor. He loves God. And God's meeting his every need. And he's finding the blessing of God. He's probably having experiences with God that money could never buy. And people are spending hundreds of dollars going out to all sorts of nightclubs and out to restaurants and out for entertainment, and they come home empty. He goes down the little corner church, waits on God, has glorious experiences with God, didn't pay a cent other than giving his tithe and offering just to the work of God because he loves God. He comes home and his soul is filled to the full. Those other people spend $500 and they come home empty. So it doesn't matter to him. He doesn't care. That's the picture. It's not a negative thing. It's not a derogatory thing. He's not presenting it so we feel sorry for this poor man. He doesn't have all this is available. Could we collect an offering to give him some groceries and so he can have a better pair of shoes? And That's not it. He knows God will meet his needs. He knows God will move on other people to help meet those needs. He knows God will help him find work when necessary and all the rest. He's just trusting God. We live in such a materialistic society. Oh, it has snared, I think, all of us to some degree. And God's going to deliver us of that. And you can read stories about all sorts of saints. And they didn't have anything really at all materially. But when you read about them, they have everything that makes you jealous. Makes you envious. You say, oh, I wished I had what he had. I'll give him this suit, this dress. He can have my. I want what he has, and that's what God's putting in our hearts. Then he says, "But the rich, in that he is made low, because of the flower of the grass, he shall pass away." Now, he's talking in verse 10 about the man of a high station in life. Now, the man in the high station, there's only one thing that he can really glory in. And the only way he can glory in that is if he's given his life to Jesus Christ. And where it says that he's now been made low, that means that he's been humbled. It means that God has been able to break through to his heart and show him that his riches will never save a soul. And so now he's been humbled before God. And now he's seeing his riches properly. He's seeing them accurately. And this is talking about a man who's got a lot of money, but now he's saved. Now his money doesn't mean a thing to him. Just like Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is a very good example. He said, I'm going to pay back every man that I've wronged four times. And I'm going to give all sorts of money to the poor. I'm going to give my money away. He realized that his money had never been able to buy him happiness. And so now it didn't matter anything to him because he'd found the answer to life. We need to have a right attitude toward money. Money is a thing that binds us up. It really does. It's really a frustration. And we're out working, and we've got these bills coming in and financial obligations. But we need God to keep working our lives to mature us so that it's just like money. It's almost like it just doesn't exist. It's just something that's there. You use it. But there's no love for it. There's no real attachment to it. We need to get free of these things in all the materialism and in the financial things and job situations where we're not encumbered. Money is a weight that so easily besets us. And if you've got a good paying job, some people, then they're really happy. And if they would happen to have a poor job, then they live in a constant dissatisfaction. And we just need to make sure, no matter what our situation, that we're keeping our eyes upon the Lord. That's what the whole point is. And that it's only that person that's going to be happy anyway. There's nobody else going to be happy. It's a hard thing, though. It's a very peculiar thing. It's one of these things almost is unexplainable. And one person who said, oh, I don't have any problem with money, that's because he has a good paying job and he doesn't owe anybody anything. That's generally the way it is right now. And then the person who has a hard time with money is the one who doesn't have the job and he's not able to pay off his debts, and so he's weighed down by it. But the truth of the matter is, no matter where we are financially, we should be able to keep our eyes upon the Lord and be at perfect peace. That doesn't mean be sloppy or ignore our responsibilities, but we need to realize that the bottom line of the whole thing is that God is going to take care of His own children. And if we will just trust Him and look to our Heavenly Father, look at how He takes care of the sparrows and how He clothes the valley with the lilies of the field and things like that. God knows how. He talks about Solomon and all of his glory, and he wasn't clothed any better than the way God clothes the hillside with the beautiful flowers and all the other things. And so this is the kind of thing that he's dealing with here. And his concern is that man would have a right attitude toward money, and that money would not be some all-important thing. To a lot of people, money is God. Money is their God. It is their major idol. It is Baal number one. And so it's a thing that we really need to resolve day by day, and we need to pray and ask God to really help us in this thing. And we need to realize we're the people that if right now if you were given $1 million, like the pastor's using an example, you say in your heart, in your mind, I would give $900,000 to the church. And if you were given $1 million today, you wouldn't give $900,000 to the church. Basically, you wouldn't. There's very few that would, really. You'd give about $100,000. And that's really the way we are. There's something in us still, and something that has brainwashed us, and that may be hard for you to accept. It's not hard for me to accept. I know it's true. I'm not totally stupid as to who I am and what makes me tick, what demons have brainwashed me. I know the world has impacted me. I know that money has impacted me. I know it. So that lets me know I better do some serious praying about this. I better make sure that I'm really coming to the cross. And this is what we have to do. And there's a lot of situations that happen in your life just to prove to you that there's still a number of things that need to be done, a number of things that need to be accomplished. And this is what he's dealing with. It's a very important thing. Money is a big problem in the church. It is a big problem in almost every Christian life. And there's very few that are the master over their money. So that money is not dominating them either in a way to kind of lift them up emotionally or to send them into despair emotionally. Money just doesn't matter to them. They just use it kind of like a necessary evil, just a part of life, and that's it. And, using it wisely, but whether they have it or they don't have it, that isn't what's going to change them as far as their emotions. They're headed for glory. And how much money they've got in their wheelbarrow right now just doesn't matter to them. And it's not that they're being foolish or being reckless, but at the same time they're not trying to be some sort of Wall Street tycoon. They're living for God, and that's their goal, is to live for God. And that doesn't mean that you can't make proper investments with your money if you feel to do so. But if you don't feel to do so, there's no need for you to do it. It's entirely up to you. It's whatever you feel in your relationship with God. That's what you have to do to take care of your family. See, as the other responsibilities come, just like those that take the mark of the beast in their hand because they want to be able to buy and sell to take care of their family. See, that's what the devil does with us. He gets us to be concerned about how we're going to meet these needs and help these others that are our responsibility. But the truth of the matter is they're not really our responsibility. They're God's responsibility. And if you're in a situation where you can't buy or sell, then you're going to have to believe God to rain the manna from heaven. Send the quail scurrying across your living room floor. Send the ravens with food in their mouths like God sent them to Elijah. That's what God's going to have to do, or else you're going to just die there. And well, fine, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But easier said than done. Sounds good, and it is. It's the right way, but we've got to get there. We've got to get there. We've got to really get to this place in God. And more people in our church need to get there, so that they're able to give their tithe and offering. For some people, to give their tithe and offering, you might as well cut off their arm. That's about as attached they are still to their money. And they're not too many, but there are some. And they're really attached to it. And when they give that check, their arm goes with it. That's how hard it is for them to give it. It's a real battle. There's a real struggle going on. The devil is raging. He's attacking them. And instead of realizing, okay, now I'm trusting God and putting Him first. And so, Lord, that means that I'm looking to you and I'm putting my life in your hands, and this is not some sort of blackmail scheme where now you are forced because I've twisted your arm and you've got to do these things. But Lord, I'm just doing it according to your word. And you said if we sought first your kingdom, then you would make sure our needs were met. And Lord, right now as I give you this money, which is the proper tithe and offering that I should give, it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to pay my bills over the next few months. So Lord, here I am. I'm doing what's right before you. Now I'm going to have to just trust you and just see what you'll do to make sure my needs are met. And you might bring it right down to 1 second before midnight and to really put me through the test. And if so, okay, give me the strength to go through that. See, it's to have the right attitude about the whole situation. And it is a vital matter, a very important thing. And when you consider all the Christian churches out here today and how many of them are impacted by the blessing pacts and the prosperity teaching, and it's everywhere. This thing is rampant. This is a monster. This is a bigger thing than the blob that ate New York City or some nonsensical thing like that. And it is just eating up churches. It's just people are being deceived left and right. And they're... They're making prosperity their God. They're making blessing their God. And if they don't have it, it shows that they lack faith. It's a terrible thing, terrible situation. Now he goes on in verse 11, he says, "For the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perishes, so also shall the rich man fade away in his ways." Now the whole point is, the rich man is not going to last. When it says the grace of the fashion, it says the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perishes, that means the beauty of its appearance. It blossoms forth, and it's beautiful, but it will fade in a very short time. In a very short time. And that's the way it is with a rich man. Life is brief. And the only thing that lasts is what we become in Jesus Christ. And we must keep this ever before our minds. Lord, the only thing that will last is what you're able to do in my soul and spirit by the moving of your spirit in my life. It's what we become in Christ. That's the only thing that will matter on the judgment day. Bank accounts, savings accounts, investments, and all the rest won't amount to anything. Somebody's business mind won't amount to anything in that day. If they were a bank president, won't amount to anything. Won't matter at all. And it's not a problem to be a bank president as long as the person would keep it in proper perspective. And it's nothing. There's nothing wrong with the rich man spending the money that he has. And he lives at a certain station of life, so he's going to buy things that are commensurate with that station of life. There's no problem with that. I wouldn't expect him to drive around in a dented up VW. I'd expect him to drive around in some sort of more expensive car. And there's no problem with that. He's got the money, and he's giving his tithe and offering. And his tithe and offering might amount to $5,000 a month. So he's giving God a full, complete percentage, and he's giving God a full offering, and then he's got this extra money left over. And what's the good of it? Of just watching it keep building up in the bank? He's already got mountains of it in the bank, and so goes out and spends it. There's no problem with that. And people can do that and have no real attachment to it. Not too many. Very, very few. But there are those who can, and we have no right to judge people and decide which ones are and which ones aren't. We can't really tell, but God knows. And so it doesn't, there's not the problem in them buying a $400 suit or $300 dress or $15,000 car. That's not the problem. That doesn't matter to God. That's no different than a person at this station of life buying a $6,000 car or a $75 suit. Just happens he's at this station and this man's at this station. There's nothing in that. That's not the problem. It's the attachment to the money, and where the person is putting their hope and their confidence. That's the problem. That's the whole issue. It's not that he drives a Rolls Royce, so he's obviously misusing his money, and this man is over here driving his little Toyota, and so he must really love God. This man driving the Rolls Royce might love God 100 times more than this man, the little Toyota. It's not the issue as to the kind of car. That's not the issue. It's the attachment to the money and the station of life. And it's where the man is putting his hope and his confidence. That's the issue. And we cannot really judge it. We cannot really tell. As far as right down to all the details and right down into the person's heart. But that's why it's a matter between us and God. See, what is your attachment and what is your feeling toward a rich person as compared to a poor person? Do you have a different attitude? Would you treat them differently? Would you love this one and show as much respect to this one as you would to this one? And that's what he's going to deal with here. And that becomes one of the major points of real practical Christian living. Can you treat all men the same with the love of God? Because each man has a soul that's of eternal value to God. And it doesn't matter how much money's in their wallet. That does not change God's love for any person. And so they're very... it's very practical. It's right down to where we live, and we have to admit that we live a lot of life with our purse and our wallet, and it's a major thing to us. But God is working in us day by day to help us more and more have our heart attached to that which is really important and have our heart divorced from the things that aren't as important, just so we have it in the right perspective. Well, we'll start on verse 12 next time.